The Two Towers, Disc 2.
Muttering, Eothyn retired and spoke to the others. Soon they drew off and left Eomer alone with the three companions. "All that you say is strange, Aragorn," he said. "Yet you speak the truth that is plain. The men of the Mark do not lie, and therefore they are not easily deceived. But you have not told all. Will you not now speak more fully of your errand, so that I may judge what to do?" "I set out from Imladris, as it is named in the rhyme, many weeks ago," answered Aragorn. "With me went Boromir of Minas Tirith. My errand was to go to that city with the son of Denethor, to aid his folk in their war against Sauron. But the company that I journeyed with had other business. Of that I cannot speak now. Gandalf the Grey was our leader." "Gandalf!" Eomer exclaimed. "Gandalf Greyhame is known in the Mark. But his name, I warn you, is no longer a password to the king's favour. He has been a guest in the land many times in the memory of men, coming as he will after a season or after many years. He is ever the herald of strange events, a bringer of evil, some now say. Indeed, since his last coming in the summer, all things have gone amiss. At that time our trouble with Saruman began. Until then we counted Saruman our friend, but Gandalf came then and warned us that sudden war was preparing in Isengard. He said that he himself had been a prisoner in Orthonk, and had hardly escaped, and he begged for help. But Theoden would not listen to him, and he went away. Speak not the name of Gandalf loudly in Theoden's ears. He is wroth. For Gandalf took the horse that is called Shadowfax, the most precious of all the king's steeds, chief of the Maiaris, which only the Lord of the Mark may ride. For the sire of their race was the great horse of Eol, that knew the speech of men. 7 nights ago Shadowfax returned, but the king's anger is not less. For now the horse is wild, and will let no man handle him." "Then Shadowfax has found his way alone from the far north," said Aragorn, "for it was there that he and Gandalf parted. But alas, Gandalf will ride no longer. He fell into darkness in the mines of Moria, and comes not again."
"That is heavy tidings," said Eomer, "at least to me, and to many. Though not to all, as you may find, if you come to the king."
"It is tidings more grievous than any in this land can understand, though it might touch them sorely ere the year is much older," said Aragorn. "But when the great fall, the less must lead. My part it has been to guide our company on the long road from Moria. Through Lorien we came, of which it were well that you should learn the truth ere you speak of it again, and thence down the leagues of the great river to the falls of Rauros. There Boromir was slain by the same orcs whom you destroyed."
"Your news is all of woe," cried Eomer in dismay.
"Great harm is this death to Minas Tirith and to us all. That was a worthy man. All spoke his praise. He came seldom to the Mark, for he was ever in the wars on the east borders. But I've seen him. More like to the swift sons of Eol than to the grave men of Gondor he seemed to me, and likely to prove a great captain of his people when his time came. But we've had no word of this grief out of Gondor. When did he fall?"
"It is now the 4th day since he was slain," answered Aragorn, "and since the evening of that day we've journeyed from the shadow of Tol Brandir."
"On foot?" cried Eomer.
"Yes, even as you see us." Wide wonder came into Eomer's eyes.
"Strider is too poor a name, son of Arathorn," he said. "Wingfoot I name you. This deed of 3 friends shall be sung in many a hall."
40 leagues and 5 you have measured, ere the 4th day is ended. Hardy is the race of Elendil. But now, lord, what would you have me do? I must return in haste to Theoden. I spoke warily before my men. It's true that we're not yet at open war with the Black Land,
and there are some, close to the king's ear, that speak craven counsels. But war is coming. We shall not forsake our old alliance with Gondor, and while they fight we shall aid them. So say I, and all who hold with me. The East Mark is my charge, the ward of the Third Marshal, and I've removed all our herds and herdfolk, withdrawing them beyond Entwash, and leaving none here but guards and swift scouts.
Then you don't pay tribute to Sauron?
Said Gimli.
We do not, and we never have, said Éomer, with a flash of his eyes, though it comes to my ears that that lie has been told. Some years ago the Lord of the Blackland wished to purchase horses of us at great price, but we refused him, for he puts beasts to evil use. Then he sent plundering orcs, and they carry off what they can, choosing always the black horses. Few of these are now left. For that reason our feud with the orcs is bitter. But at this time our chief concern is with Saruman. He's claimed lordship over all this land, and there has been war between us for many months. He has taken orcs into his service, and wolf riders, and evil men, and he has closed the gap against us, so that we are likely to be beset both east and west. It's ill dealing with such a foe. He is a wizard both cunning and dwimmer crafty, having many guises. He walks here and there, they say, as an old man hooded and cloaked, very like to Gandalf, as many now recall. His spies slip through every net, and his birds of ill omen are abroad in the sky. I don't know how it will all end, and my heart misgives me, for it seems to me that his friends don't all dwell in Isengard. But if you come to the king's house, you shall see for yourself. Will you not come? Do I hope in vain that you have been sent to me for a help in doubt and need?
I will come when I may, said Aragorn.
Come now, said Éomer.
The heir of Elendil would be a strength indeed to the sons of Eorl in this evil tide. There is battle even now upon the West Emnet, and I fear that it may go ill for us. Indeed, in this riding north I went without the king's leave, for in my absence his house is left with little guard. But scouts warned me of the Orcoast coming down out of the east wall 3 nights ago, and among them they reported that some bore the white badges of Saruman. So suspecting what I most fear, a league between Orthanc and the Dark Tower, I led forth my Eorid, men of my own household, and we overtook the Orcs at nightfall 2 days ago, near to the borders of the Entwood. There we surrounded them, and gave battle yesterday at dawn. 15 of my men I lost, and 12 horses, alas. For the Orcs were greater in number than we counted on. Others joined them, coming out of the east across the great river. Their trail is plain to see a little north of this spot. And others, too, came out of the forest, great Orcs, who also bore the white hand of Isengard. That kind is stronger and more fell than all the others. Nonetheless, we put an end to them. But we have been too long away. We are needed south and west. Will you not come? There are spare horses, as you see. There is work for the sword to do. Yes, and we could find a use for Gimli's axe and the bow of Legolas, if they will pardon my rash words concerning the Lady of the Wood. I spoke only as do all men in my land, and I would gladly learn better.
I thank you for your fair words, said Aragorn, and my heart desires to come with you, but I cannot desert my friends while hope remains.
Hope does not remain, said Éomer. You will not find your friends on the north borders.
Yet my friends are not behind. We found a clear token not far from the east wall that one at least of them was still alive there. But between the wall and the downs we've found no other trace of them, and no trail has turned aside, this way or that, unless my skill has wholly left me.
Then what do you think has become of them?
I don't know. They may have been slain and burned among the orcs.
But that, you will say, can't be, and I don't fear it. I can only think that they were carried off into the forest before the battle,
even before you encircled your foes, maybe. Can you swear that none escaped your net in such a way?
I would swear that no orc escaped after we sighted them, said Éomer. We reached the forest eaves before them, and if after that any living thing broke through our ring, then it was no orc, and had some elvish power.
Our friends were attired even as we were, said Aragorn.
And you passed us by under the full light of day?
I'd forgotten that, said Éomer. It's hard to be sure of anything among so many marbles. The world is all grown strange. Elf and dwarf in company walk in our daily fields. And folks speak with the Lady of the Wood and yet live. And the sword comes back to war that was broken in the long ages, ere the fathers of our fathers rode into the mark. How shall a man judge what to do in such times?
As he ever has judged, said Aragorn. Good and ill have not changed since yesteryear, nor are they one thing among elves and dwarves, and another among men. It's a man's part to discern them, as much in the Golden Wood as in his own house.
True indeed, said Éomer, but I don't doubt you, nor the deed which my heart would do, yet I'm not free to do all as I would. It's against our law to let strangers wander at will in our land, until the king himself shall give them leave, and more strict is the command in these days of peril. I begged you to come back willingly with me, and you won't. Loath am I to begin a battle of 100 against 3.
I don't think your law was made for such a chance, said Aragorn, nor indeed am I a stranger, for I've been in this land before, more than once, and ridden with the host of the Rohirrim, though under other name and in other guise. You I haven't seen before, for you are young, but I have spoken with Éomund, your father, and with Théoden, son of Thingol. Never in former days would any high lord of this land have constrained a man to abandon such a quest as mine. My duty at least is clear, to go on. Come now, son of Éomund, the choice must be made at last. Aid us, or at the worst let us go free, or seek to carry out your law. If you do so, there will be fewer to return to your war or to your king. Éomer was silent for a moment, then he spoke.
We both have need of haste, he said. My company chafes to be away, and every hour lessens your hope. This is my choice. You may go, and what is more, I will lend you horses. This only I ask. When your quest is achieved, or is proved vain, return with the horses over the Entwade to Medaseld, the high house in Edoras where Théoden now sits. Thus you shall prove to him that I have not misjudged. In this I place myself, and maybe my very life, in the keeping of your good faith. Don't fail. I will not, said Aragorn.
There was great wonder, and many dark and doubtful glances among his men, when Éomer gave orders that the spare horses were to be lent to the strangers, but only Éothain dared to speak openly.
It may be well enough for this lord of the race of Gondor, as he claims, he said, but who has heard of a horse of the mark being given to a dwarf?
No one, said Gimli, and do not trouble. No one will ever hear of it. I would sooner walk than sit on the back of any beast so great, free or begrudged.
But you must ride now, or you will hinder us, said Aragorn.
Come, you shall sit behind me, friend Gimli, said Legolas. Then all will be well, and you need neither borrow a horse nor be troubled by one.
A great dark grey horse was brought to Aragorn, and he mounted it.
Harzufel is his name, said Éomer. May he bear you well, and a better fortune than Gardulf, his late master.
A smaller and lighter horse, but restive and fiery, was brought to Legolas. Arod was his name. But Legolas asked them to take off saddle and rein.
I need them not, he said, and leapt lightly up, and to their wonder Arod was tame and willing beneath him, moving here and there
with but a spoken word. Such was the elvish way with all good beasts. Gimli was lifted up behind his friend, and he clung to him, not much more at ease than Sam Gamgee in a boat.
"Farewell, and may you find what you seek," said Aylmer. "Return with what speed you may, and let our swords hereafter shine together."
"I will come," said Aragorn.
"And I will come too," said Gimli. "The matter of the Lady Galadriel lies between us. I have yet to teach you gentle speech."
"We shall see," said Aylmer. "So many strange things have chanced that to learn the praise of a fair lady under the loving strokes of a dwarf's axe will seem no great wonder. Farewell!"
With that they parted. Very swift were the horses of Rohan. When after a little Gimli looked back, the company of Aylmer were already small and far away. Aragorn did not look back. He was watching the trail as they sped on their way, bending low with his head beside the neck of Harsifel. Before long they came to the borders of the Entwash, and there they met the other trail of which Aylmer spoke, coming down from the east out of the wold. Aragorn dismounted and surveyed the ground. Then, leaping back into the saddle, he rode away for some distance eastward, keeping to one side and taking care not to override the footprints. Then he again dismounted and examined the ground, going backwards and forwards on foot.
"There's little to discover," he said when he returned. "The main trail is all confused with the passage of the horsemen as they came back. Their outward course must have lain nearer the river, but this eastward trail is fresh and clear. There's no sign there of any feet going the other way, back towards Anduin. Now we must ride slower, and make sure that no trace or footstep branches off on either side." The orcs must have been aware from this point that they were pursued. They may have made some attempt to get their captives away before they were overtaken. As they rode forward, the day was overcast. Low grey clouds came over the wold. A mist shrouded the sun. Ever nearer the tree-clad slopes of Fangorn loomed, slowly darkling as the sun went west. They saw no sign of any trail to right or left, but here and there they passed single orcs, fallen in their tracks as they ran, with grey feathered arrows sticking in back or throat. At last, as the afternoon was waning, they came to the eaves of the forest, and in an open glade among the first trees they found the place of the great burning. The ashes were still hot and smoking. Beside it was a great pile of helms and mail, cloven shields and broken swords, bows and darts and other gear of war. Upon a stake in the middle was set a great goblin head. Upon its shattered helm the white badge could still be seen. Further away, not far from the river, where it came streaming out from the edge of the wood, there was a mound. It was newly raised. The raw earth was covered with fresh-cut turves. About it were planted 15 spears. Aragorn and his companions searched far and wide about the field of battle, but the light faded, and evening soon grew down, dim and misty. By nightfall they had discovered no trace of Merry and Pippin.
"We can do no more," said Gimli sadly. "We've been set many riddles since we came to Tol Brandir, but this is the hardest to unravel. I would guess that the burned bones of the hobbits are now mingled with the orcs. It'll be hard news for Frodo, if he lives to hear it, and hard too for the old hobbit who waits in Rivendell. Elrond was against their coming."
"But Gandalf was not," said Legolas.
"But Gandalf chose to come himself, and he was the first to be lost," answered Gimli. "His foresight failed him."
"The counsel of Gandalf was not founded on foreknowledge of safety for himself or for others," said Aragorn. "There are some things that it's better to begin than to refuse, even though the end may be dark. But I shall not depart from this place yet. In any case, we must here await the morning light."
A little way beyond the battlefield, they made their camp under a spreading tree.
It looked like a chestnut, and yet it still bore many broad brown leaves of a former year, like dry hands with long splayed fingers. They rattled mournfully in the night breeze. Gimli shivered. They had brought only one blanket apiece.
"Let's light a fire," he said. "I care no longer for the danger. Let the orcs come as thick as summer moths round a candle."
"If those unhappy hobbits are astray in the woods, it might draw them hither," said Legolas.
"And it might draw other things, neither orc nor hobbit," said Aragorn. "We're near to the mountain marches of the traitor Saruman, and also we're on the very edge of Fangorn, and it's perilous to touch the trees of that wood, it is said."
"But the Rohir made a great burning here yesterday," said Gimli, "and they felled trees for the fire, as can be seen. Yet they passed the night away safely here, when their labour was ended."
"There were many," said Aragorn,
"and they don't heed the wrath of Fangorn, for they come here seldom, and they don't go under the trees. But our paths are likely to lead us into the very forest itself, so have a care. Cut no living wood."
"There's no need," said Gimli. "The riders have left chip and bough enough, and there's dead wood lying in plenty."
He went off to gather fuel, and busied himself with building and kindling a fire, but Aragorn sat silently with his back to the great tree, deep in thought, and Legolas stood alone in the open, looking towards the profound shadow of the wood, leaning forward, as one who listens to voices calling from a distance. When the dwarf had a small, bright blaze going, the three companions drew close to it and sat together, shrouding the light with their hooded forms. Legolas looked up at the boughs of the tree reaching out above them.
"Look," he said, "the tree is glad of the fire."
It may have been that the dancing shadows tricked their eyes, but certainly to each of the companions the boughs appeared to be bending this way and that so as to come above the flames, while the upper branches were stooping down. The brown leaves now stood out stiff, and rubbed together like many cold, cracked hands taking comfort in the warmth. There was a silence, for suddenly the dark and unknown forest, so near at hand, made itself felt as a great brooding presence, full of secret purpose. After a while, Legolas spoke again.
"Caraborn warned us not to go far into Fangorn," he said. "Do you know why, Aragorn? What are the fables of the forest that Boromir had heard?"
"I've heard many tales in Gondor and elsewhere," said Aragorn. "But if it weren't for the words of Celeborn, I should deem them only fables that men have made as true knowledge fades. I thought of asking you what was the truth of the matter, and if an elf of the wood doesn't know, how shall a man answer?"
"You've journeyed further than I," said Legolas. "I've heard nothing of this in my own land, save only songs that tell how the Onodrim, the men called Ents, dwelt there long ago. But Fangorn is old, old even as the elves would reckon it."
"Yes, it's old," said Aragorn, "as old as the forest by the Barrow Downs, and it's far greater.
Elrond says that the two are akin, the last strongholds of the mighty woods of the elder days, in which the firstborn roamed while men still slept. But Fangorn holds some secret of its own. What it is, I don't know."
"I don't wish to know," said Gimli. "Let nothing that dwells in Fangorn be troubled on my account."
They now drew lots for the watchers, and the lot for the first watch fell to Gimli. The others lay down. Almost at once, sleep laid hold on them.
"Gimli," said Aragorn drowsily, "remember, it's perilous to cut bough or twig from a living tree in Fangorn, but don't stray far in search of dead wood. Let the fire die, rather. Call me at need."
With that he fell asleep. Legolas already lay motionless, his fair hands folded upon his breast, his eyes unclosed, blending living night and deep dream, as is the way with elves. Gimli sat hunched by the fire, running his thumb thoughtfully along the edge of his axe. The tree rustled. There was no other sound. Suddenly Gimli looked up,
And there, just on the edge of the firelight, stood an old bent man, leaning on a staff, and wrapped in a great cloak. His wide-brimmed hat was pulled down over his eyes. Gimli sprang up, too amazed for the moment to cry out, though at once the thought flashed into his mind that Saruman had caught them. Both Aragorn and Legolas, aroused by his sudden movement, sat up and stared. The old man didn't speak or make a sign.
"Well, father, what can we do for you?" said Aragorn, leaping to his feet. "Come and be warm if you're cold."
He strode forward, but the old man was gone. There was no trace of him to be found near at hand, and they didn't dare to wander far. The moon had set, and the night was very dark. Suddenly Legolas gave a cry. "The horses! The horses!" The horses were gone. They dragged their pickets and disappeared. For some time the three companions stood still and silent, troubled by this new stroke of ill fortune. They were under the eaves of Fangorn, and endless leagues lay between them and the men of Rohan, their only friends in this wide and dangerous land. As they stood, it seemed to them that they heard, far off in the night, the sound of horses whinnying and neighing. Then all was quiet again, except for the cold rustle of the wind.
"Well, they're gone," said Aragorn at last. "We can't find them or catch them, so that if they don't return of their own free will, we must do without. We started on our own feet, and we have those still."
"Feet," said Gimli. "But we can't eat them as well as walk on them."
He threw some fuel on the fire and slumped down beside it.
"Only a few hours ago you were unwilling to sit on a horse of Rohan," laughed Legolas. "But you'll make a rider yet."
"It seems unlikely that I shall have the chance," said Gimli. "If you wish to know what I think," he began again after a while, "I think it was Saruman. Who else? Remember the words of Éomer. He walks about like an old man hooded and cloaked. Those were the words. He's gone off with our horses, or scared them away, and here we are. There's more trouble coming to us, mark my words."
"I mark them," said Aragorn. "But I marked also that this old man had a hat, not a hood. Still, I don't doubt that you guess right, and that we're in peril here, by night or day. Yet in the meantime, there is nothing that we can do but rest, while we may. I'll watch for a while now, Gimli. I've more need of thought than of sleep." The night passed slowly. Legolas followed Aragorn, and Gimli followed Legolas, and their watches wore away. But nothing happened. The old man didn't appear again, and the horses did not return.
Chapter 3.
The Uruk-hai.
Pippin lay in a dark and troubled dream. It seemed that he could hear his own small voice echoing in black tunnels, calling Frodo, Frodo. But instead of Frodo, hundreds of hideous orc faces grinned at him out of the shadows. Hundreds of hideous arms grasped at him from every side. Where was Merry? He woke. Cold air blew on his face. He was lying on his back. Evening was coming, and the sky above was growing dim. He turned and found that the dream was little worse than the waking. His wrists, legs, and ankles were tied with cords. Beside him Merry lay, white-faced, with a dirty rag bound across his brows. All about them sat or stood a great company of orcs. Slowly in Pippin's aching head, memory pieced itself together and became separated from dream shadows. Of course, he and Merry had run off into the woods. What had come over them? Why had they dashed off like that, taking no notice of old Strider? They'd run a long way, shouting. He couldn't remember how far or how long, and then suddenly they'd crashed right into a group of orcs. They were standing listening, and they didn't appear to see Merry and Pippin until they were almost in their arms. Then they yelled, and dozens of other goblins had sprung out of the trees. Merry and he had drawn their swords, but the orcs didn't wish to fight, and had tried only to lay hold of them, even when Merry had cut off several of their arms and hands.
could hold Merry. Then Boromir had come leaping through the trees. He had made them fight. He slew many of them, and the rest fled. But they hadn't gone far on the way back when they were attacked again by 100 orcs at least, some of them very large, and they shot a rain of arrows, always at Boromir. Boromir had blown his great horn till the woods rang, and at first the orcs had been dismayed and had drawn back. But when no answer but the echoes came, they'd attacked more fiercely than ever. Pippin didn't remember much more. His last memory was of Boromir leaning against a tree, plucking out an arrow. Then darkness fell suddenly. "I suppose I was knocked on the head," he said to himself. "I wonder if poor Merry is much hurt. What has happened to Boromir? Why didn't the orcs kill us? Where are we? And where are we going?" He couldn't answer the questions. He felt cold and sick. "I wish Gandalf had never persuaded Elrond to let us come," he thought. "What good have I been? Just a nuisance, a passenger, a piece of luggage. And now I've been stolen, and I'm just a piece of luggage for the orcs. I hope Strider or someone will come and claim us. But ought I to hope for it? Won't that throw out all the plans? I wish I could get free." He struggled a little, quite uselessly. One of the orcs sitting near laughed and said something to a companion in their abominable tongue.
"Rest while you can, little fool," he said then to Pippin, in the common speech, which he made almost as hideous as his own language. "Rest while you can. We'll find a use for your legs before long. You'll wish you'd got none before we get home."
"If I had my way, you'd wish you were dead now," said the other. "I'll make you squeak, you miserable rat."
He stooped over Pippin, bringing his yellow fangs close to his face. He had a black knife with a long jagged blade in his hand.
"Lie quiet, or I'll tickle you with this," he hissed. "Don't draw attention to yourself, or I may forget my orders. Curse the Isengarders.
Ugluk a bagrong sha push dug saramon globuko sky."
He passed into a long, angry speech in his own tongue that slowly died away into muttering and snarling. Terrified, Pippin lay still, though the pain at his wrists and ankles was growing, and the stones beneath him were boring into his back. To take his mind off himself, he listened intently to all that he could hear. There were many voices round him, and though orc speech sounded at all times full of hate and anger, it seemed plain that something like a quarrel had begun and was getting hotter. To Pippin's surprise, he found that much of the talk was intelligible. Many of the orcs were using ordinary language. Apparently the members of two or three quite different tribes were present, and they couldn't understand one another's orc speech. There was an angry debate concerning what they were to do now, which way they were to take, and what should be done with the prisoners.
"There's no time to kill them properly,"
said one.
"No time for play on this trip."
"That can't be helped," said another. "But why not kill them quick? Kill them now. They're a cursed nuisance, and we're in a hurry. Evening's coming on, and we ought to get a move on."
"Orders," said a third voice in a deep growl. "Kill all but not the halflings. They're to be brought back alive as quickly as possible. That's my orders."
"What are they wanted for?"
asked several voices. "Why alive? Do they give sport?"
"No, I heard that one of them has got something that's wanted for the war, some elvish plot or other. Anyway, they'll both be questioned."
"Is that all you know? Why don't we search them and find out? We might find something that we could use ourselves."
"That is a very interesting remark," sneered a voice, softer than the others but more evil. "I may have to report that. The prisoners are not to be searched or plundered. Those are my orders."
"And mine too," said the deep voice.
alive and as captured. No spoiling. That's my orders.
Not our orders, said one of the earlier voices. We've come all the way from the mines to kill and avenge our folk. I wish to kill and then go back north.
And you can wish again, said the growling voice. I am Ugluk. I command. I return to Isengard by the shortest road.
Is Saruman the master of the Great Eye? Said the evil voice. We should go back at once to Lugbor's.
If we could cross the great river, we might, said another voice. But there aren't enough of us to venture down to the bridges.
I came across, said the evil voice. A winged Nazgul awaits us northward on the east bank.
Maybe, maybe. Then you'll fly off with our prisoners and get all the pay and praise in Lugbor's and leave us to foot it as best we can through the horse country. No, we must stick together. These lands are dangerous, full of foul rebels and brigands.
Aye, we must stick together, growled Ugluk. I don't trust you, little swine. You've no guts outside your own styes. But for us, you'd all have run away. We are fighting Uruk-hai. We slew the great warrior. We took the prisoners. We are the servants of Saruman the Wise, the White Hand, the hand that gives us men's flesh to eat. We came out of Isengard and led you here, and we shall lead you back by the way we choose. I am Ugluk. I have spoken.
You have spoken more than enough, Ugluk, sneered the evil voice. I wonder how they would like it in Lugbor's. They might think that Ugluk's shoulders needed relieving of a swollen head. They might ask where his strange ideas came from. Did they come from Saruman, perhaps? Who does he think he is, sitting up on his own with his filthy white badges? They might agree with me. With Grishnak, their trusted messenger, and I, Grishnak, say this. Saruman is a fool, and a dirty, treacherous fool, but the Great Eye is on him.
Swine, is it? How do you folk like being called swine by the muckrakers of a dirty little wizard? It's orc flesh they eat, I'll warrant.
Many loud yells in orc speech answered him, and the ringing clash of weapons being drawn. Cautiously Pippin rolled over, hoping to see what would happen. His guards had gone to join in the fray. In the twilight he saw a large black orc, probably Ugluk, standing facing Grishnak, a short, crook-legged creature, very broad and with long arms that hung almost to the ground. Round them were many smaller goblins. Pippin supposed that these were the ones from the north. They had drawn their knives and swords, but hesitated to attack Ugluk. Ugluk shouted, and a number of other orcs of nearly his own size ran up. Then suddenly, without warning, Ugluk sprang forwards, and with two swift strokes swept the heads off two of his opponents. Grishnak stepped aside and vanished into the shadows. The others gave way, and one stepped backwards and fell over Merry's prostrate form with a curse. Yet that probably saved his life, for Ugluk's followers leapt over him and cut down another with their broad-bladed swords. It was the yellow-fanged guard. His body fell right on top of Pippin, still clutching its long, saw-edged knife.
"Put up your weapons!" shouted Ugluk. "And let's have no more nonsense. We go straight west from here and down the stair. From there straight to the downs, then along the river to the forest, and we march day and night. That clear?"
Now, thought Pippin, if only it takes that ugly fellow a little while to get his troop under control, I've got a chance. A gleam of hope had come to him. The edge of the black knife had snicked his arm and then slid down to his wrist. He felt the blood trickling onto his hand, but he also felt the cold touch of steel against his skin. The orcs were getting ready to march again, but some of the northerners were still unwilling, and the Isengarders slew two more before the rest were cowed. There was much cursing and confusion.
for the moment Pippin was unwatched. His legs were securely bound, but his arms were only tied about the wrists, and his hands were in front of him. He could move them both together, though the bonds were cruelly tight. He pushed the dead orc to one side, then, hardly daring to breathe, he drew the knot of the wrist cord up and down against the blade of the knife. It was sharp, and the dead hand held it fast. The cord was cut. Quickly Pippin took it in his fingers and knotted it again into a loose bracelet of two loops and slipped it over his hands. Then he lay very still.
"Pick up those prisoners," shouted Ugluk. "Don't play any tricks with them. If they're not alive when we get back, someone else will die too."
An orc seized Pippin like a sack, put its head between his tied hands, grabbed his arms and dragged them down until Pippin's face was crushed against its neck. Then it jolted off with him. Another treated Merry in the same way. The orc's claw-like hand gripped Pippin's arms like iron. The nails bit into him. He shut his eyes and slipped back into evil dreams. Suddenly he was thrown onto the stony floor again. It was early night, but the slim moon was already falling westward. They were on the edge of a cliff that seemed to look out over a sea of pale mist. There was a sound of water falling nearby.
"The scouts have come back at last," said an orc close at hand.
"Well, what did you discover?"
growled the voice of Ugluk.
"Only a single horseman, and he made off westward. All's clear now."
"Now, I dare say. But how long, you fools? You should have shot him. He'll raise the alarm. The cursed horse breeders will hear of us by morning. Now we'll have to leg it double quick."
A shadow bent over Pippin. It was Ugluk.
"Sit up," said the orc. "My lads are tired of lugging you about. We've got to climb down, and you must use your legs. Be careful now. No crying out. No trying to escape. We have ways of paying for tricks that you won't like, though they won't spoil your usefulness for the master."
He cut the thongs round Pippin's legs and ankles, picked him up by his hair, and stood him on his feet. Pippin fell down, and Ugluk dragged him up by his hair again. Several orcs laughed. Ugluk thrust a flask between his teeth and poured some burning liquid down his throat. He felt a hot, fierce glow flow through him. The pain in his legs and ankles vanished. He could stand.
"Now for the other," said Ugluk.
Pippin saw him go to Merry, who was lying close by, and kick him. Merry groaned. Seizing him roughly, Ugluk pulled him into a sitting position and tore the bandage off his head. Then he smeared the wound with some dark stuff out of a small wooden box. Merry cried out and struggled wildly. The orcs clapped and hooted.
"Can't take his medicine," they jeered. "Doesn't know what's good for him. Aye, we shall have some fun later."
But at the moment, Ugluk wasn't engaged in sport. He needed speed and had to humour unwilling followers. He was healing Merry in orc fashion, and his treatment worked swiftly. When he'd forced a drink from his flask down the hobbit's throat, cut his leg bonds, and dragged him to his feet, Merry stood up, looked pale but grim and defiant, and very much alive. The gash in his forehead gave him no more trouble, but he bore a brown scar to the end of his days.
"Hallo, Pippin," he said. "So you've come on this little expedition too. Where do we get bed and breakfast?"
"Now then," said Ugluk, "none of that. Hold your tongues. No talk to one another. Any trouble will be reported at the other end, and he'll know how to pay you. You'll get bed and breakfast all right, more than you can stomach."
The orc band began to descend a narrow ravine leading down into the misty plain below. Merry and Pippin, separated by a dozen orcs or more, climbed down with them. At the bottom they stepped onto grass, and the hearts of the hobbits rose.
"Now straight on," shouted Ugluk. "West and a little north, follow Lugdush."
"But what are we going to do at sunrise?"
said some of the northerners.
Go on running, said Ugluk. What do you think? Sit on the grass and wait for the white skins to join the picnic? But we can't run in the sunlight. You'll run with me behind you, said Ugluk. Run, or you'll never see your beloved holes again. By the White Hand, what's the use of sending out mountain maggots on a trip only half-trained? Run, curse you, run while night lasts.
Then the whole company began to run with the long, loping strides of orcs. They kept no order, thrusting, jostling and cursing, yet their speed was very great. Each hobbit had a guard of three. Pippin was far back in the line. He wondered how long he would be able to go on at this pace. He had had no food since the morning. One of his guards had a whip. But at present the orc liquor was still hot in him. His wits, too, were wide awake. Every now and again there came into his mind, unbidden, a vision of the keen face of Strider, bending over a dark trail, and running behind. But what could even a ranger see except a confused trail of orc feet? His own little prince and Merry's were overwhelmed by the trampling of the iron-shod shoes before them, and behind them, and about them. They had gone only a mile or so from the cliff, when the land sloped down into a wide, shallow depression, where the ground was soft and wet. Mist lay there, pale glimmering in the last rays of the sickle moon. The dark shapes of the orcs in front grew dim, and then were swallowed up.
"Aye, steady now!" shouted Ugluk from the rear.
A sudden thought leapt into Pippin's mind, and he acted on it at once. He swerved aside to the right, and dived out of the reach of his clutching guard, head first into the mist. He landed sprawling on the grass.
"Halt!" yelled Ugluk.
There was for a moment turmoil and confusion. Pippin sprang up and ran, but the orcs were after him. Some suddenly loomed up right in front of him.
No hope of escape, thought Pippin. But there is a hope that I've left some of my own marks unspoiled on the wet ground.
He groped with his two tied hands at his throat and unclasped the brooch of his cloak. Just as long arms and hard claws seized him, he let it fall.
There, I suppose it'll lie until the end of time, he thought. I don't know why I did it. If the others have escaped, they've probably all gone with Frodo.
A whip-thong curled round his legs, and he stifled a cry.
Enough, shouted Ugluk, running up. He's still got to run a long way yet. Make 'em both run. Just use the whip as a reminder. But that's not all, he snarled, turning to Pippin. I shan't forget. Payment is only put off. Leg it.
Neither Pippin nor Merry remembered much of the later part of the journey. Evil dreams and evil waking were blended into a long tunnel of misery, with hope growing ever fainter behind. They ran, and they ran, striving to keep up the pace set by the orcs, licked every now and again with a cruel thong cunningly handled. If they halted or stumbled, they were seized and dragged for some distance. The warmth of the orc draught had gone. Pippin felt cold and sick again. Suddenly he fell face downward on the turf. Hard hands with rending nails gripped and lifted him. He was carried like a sack once more, and darkness grew about him. Whether the darkness of another night, or a blindness of his eyes, he couldn't tell. Dimly he became aware of voices clamouring. It seemed that many of the orcs were demanding a halt. Ugluk was shouting. He felt himself flung to the ground, and he lay as he fell, till black dreams took him. But he didn't long escape from pain. Soon the iron grip of merciless hands was on him again. For a long time he was tossed and shaken, and then slowly the darkness gave way, and he came back to the waking world and found that it was morning. Orders were shouted, and he was thrown roughly on the grass. There he lay for a while, fighting with despair. His head swam, but from the heat in his body he guessed that he'd been given another draught. An orc stooped over him and flung him some bread and a strip of raw dried flesh. He ate the stale bread hungrily, but not the meat. He was famished, but not yet so famished as to eat flesh flung to him by an orc, the flesh of he dared not guess what creature.
He sat up and looked about. Merry was not far away. They were by the banks of a swift, narrow river. Ahead mountains loomed. A tall peak was catching the first rays of the sun. A dark smudge of forest lay on the lower slopes before them. There was much shouting and debating among the orcs. A quarrel seemed on the point of breaking out again between the northerners and the Isengarders. Some were pointing back away south, and some were pointing eastward.
"Very well," said Ugluk. "Leave them to me, then. No killing, as I've told you before. But if you want to throw away what we've come all the way to get, throw it away. I'll look after it. Let the fighting Uruk-hai do the work as usual. If you're afraid of the whiteskins, run. Run. There's the forest," he shouted, pointing ahead. "Get to it. It's your best hope. Off you go, and quick, before I knock a few more heads off to put some sense into the others."
There was some cursing and scuffling, and then most of the northerners broke away and dashed off, over 100 of them, running wildly along the river towards the mountains. The hobbits were left with the Isengarders, a grim dark band, 40 at least of large, swart, slant-eyed orcs with great bows and short, broad-bladed swords. A few of the larger and bolder northerners remained with them.
"Now we'll deal with Grishnak," said Ugluk.
But some even of his own followers were looking uneasily southwards.
"I know," growled Ugluk. "The cursed horse boys have got wind of us. But that's all your fault, Snager. You and the other scouts ought to have your ears cut off. But we are the fighters. We'll feast on horse flesh yet, or something better."
At that moment, Pippin saw why some of the troop had been pointing eastward. From that direction there now came hoarse cries, and there was Grishnak again, and at his back a couple of score of others like him, long-armed, crooked-leg orcs. They had a red eye painted on their shields. Ugluk stepped forward to meet them.
"So you've come back," he said. "Thought better of it, eh?"
"I've returned to see that orders are carried out and the prisoners safe," answered Grishnak.
"Indeed," said Ugluk. "Waste of effort. I'll see that orders are carried out in my command. And what else did you come back for? You went in a hurry. Did you leave anything behind?"
"I left a fool," snarled Grishnak. "But there were some stout fellows with him, and they're too good to lose. I knew you'd lead them into a mess. I've come to help them."
"Splendid," laughed Ugluk. "But unless you've got some guts for fighting, you've taken the wrong way. Lugbor's was your road. The whiteskins are coming. What's happened to your precious Nazgul? Has he had another mount shot under him? Now, if you've brought him along, that might have been useful, if these Nazgul are all they make out."
"Nazgul, Nazgul," shouted Grishnak, shivering and licking his lips, as if the word had a foul taste that he savoured painfully. "You speak of what is deep beyond the reach of your muddy dreams, Ugluk," he said. "Nazgul? Ah, all that they make out. One day you'll wish that you hadn't said that, ape,"
he snarled fiercely.
"You ought to know that they're the apple of the great eye. But the winged Nazgul, not yet, not yet. He won't let them show themselves across the great river yet. Not too soon. They're for the war and other purposes."
"You seem to know a lot," said Ugluk. "More than is good for you, I guess. Perhaps those in Lugbor's might wonder how and why. But in the meantime, the Uruk-hai of Isengard can do the dirty work as usual. Don't stand slavering there. Get your rabble together. The other swine are legging it to the forest. You'd better follow. You wouldn't get back to the great river alive. Right, off the mark. Now, I'll be on your heels."
The Isengarders seized Merry and Pippin again and slung them on their backs. Then the troop started off. Hour after hour they ran, pausing now and again only to sling the hobbits to fresh carriers, either because they were quicker and hardier, or because of some plan of Grishnak's. The Isengarders gradually passed through the orcs of Mordor, and Grishnak's folk closed in behind.
Soon they were gaining also on the northerners ahead. The forest began to draw nearer. Pippin was bruised and torn. His aching head was grated by the filthy jowl and hairy ear of the orc that held him. Immediately in front were bowed backs, and tough, thick legs going up and down, unresting, as if they were made of wire and horn, beating out the nightmare seconds of an endless time. In the afternoon, Ugluk's troop overtook the northerners. They were flagging in the rays of the bright sun, winter sun shining in a pale, cool sky though it was. Their heads were down and their tongues lolling out.
"Maggots," jeered the Isengarders. "You're cooked. The white skins will catch you and eat you. They're coming."
A cry from Grishnak showed that this was not mere jest. Horsemen, riding very swiftly, had indeed been sighted, still far behind, but gaining on the orcs, gaining on them like a tide over the flats on folk straying in quicksand. The Isengarders began to run with the redoubled pace that astonished Pippin, a terrific spurt, it seemed, for the end of a race. Then he saw that the sun was sinking, falling behind the misty mountains. Shadows reached over the land. The soldiers of Mordor lifted their heads and also began to put on speed. The forest was dark and close. Already they had passed a few outlying trees. The land was beginning to slope upwards ever more steeply, but the orcs didn't halt. Both Ugluk and Grishnak shouted, spurring them on to a last effort.
"They'll make it yet. They'll escape," thought Pippin.
And then he managed to twist his neck so as to glance back with one eye over his shoulder. He saw that riders away eastward were already level with the orcs, galloping over the plain. The sunset gilded their spears and helmets and glinted in their pale, flowing hair. They were hemming the orcs in, preventing them from scattering, and driving them along over the line of the river. He wondered very much what kind of folk they were. He wished now that he had learned more in Rivendell and looked more at maps and things. But in those days the plans for the journey seemed to be in more competent hands, and he'd never reckoned with being cut off from Gandalf or from Strider and even from Frodo. All that he could remember about Rohan was that Gandalf's horse, Shadowfax, had come from that land. That sounded hopeful as far as it went. "But how will they know that we're not orcs?" he thought. "I don't suppose they've ever heard of hobbits down here. I suppose I ought to be glad that the beastly orcs look like being destroyed, but I'd rather be saved myself." The chances were that he and Merry would be killed together with their captors before even the men of Rohan were aware of them. A few of the riders appeared to be bowmen, skilled at shooting from a running horse. Riding swiftly into range, they shot arrows at the orcs that straggled behind, and several of them fell. Then the riders wheeled away out of the range of the answering bows of their enemies, who shot wildly, not daring to talk. This happened many times, and on one occasion arrows fell among the Isengarders. One of them, just in front of Pippin, stumbled and did not get up again. Night came down without the riders closing in for battle. Many orcs had fallen, but fully 200 remained. In the early darkness the orcs came to a hillock. The eaves of the forest were very near, probably no more than 3 furlongs away, but they could go no further. The horsemen had encircled them. A small band disobeyed Ugluk's command and ran on towards the forest. Only 3 returned.
"Well, here we are," sneered Grishnak. "Fine leadership. I hope the great Ugluk will lead us out again."
"Put those halflings down," ordered Ugluk, taking no notice of Grishnak. "You, Lugdush, get 2 others and stand guard over them. They're not to be killed unless the filthy whiteskins break through, understand? As long as I'm alive, I want them. But they're not to cry out, and they're not to be rescued. Bind their legs."
The last part of the order was carried out mercilessly, but Pippin found that for the first time he was close to Merry. The orcs were making a great deal of noise, shouting and clashing their weapons, and the hobbits managed to whisper together for a while.
"I don't think much of this," said Merry. "I feel nearly done in. Don't think I could crawl away far, even if I was free."
"Lembas," whispered Pippin. "Lembas, I've got some. Have you? I don't think they've taken anything but our swords."
"Yes, I had a packet in my pocket," answered Merry. "But it must be better to crumbs. Anyway, I can't put my mouth in my pocket."
"You won't have to. I've—"
But just then a savage kick warned Pippin that the noise had died down, and the guards were watchful. The night was dark and cold. All round the knoll on which the orcs were gathered, little watchfires sprang up, gold and red in the darkness, a complete ring of them. They were within a long bowshot, but the riders didn't show themselves against the light, and the orcs wasted many arrows shooting at the fires until a Glück stopped them. The riders made no sound. Later in the night, when the moon came out of the mist, then occasionally they could be seen, shadowy shapes that glinted now and again in the white light as they moved in ceaseless patrol.
"They'll wait for the sun, curse them," growled one of the guards. "Why don't we get together and charge through? What's old Ugdruk think he's doing, I should like to know?"
"I dare say you would," snarled Ugdruk, stepping up from behind. "Meaning I don't think at all, eh? Curse you! You're as bad as the other rebel, the maggots and the apes of Lugmoors. No good trying to charge with them. They just squeal and bolt, and there are more than enough of these filthy horse boys to mop up our lot on the flat. There's only one thing those maggots can do. They can see like gimlets in the dark. But these white skins have better night eyes than most men, from all I've heard. And don't forget their horses. They can see the night breeze, or so it's said. Still, there's one thing the fine fellows don't know. Mahor and his lads are in the forest, and they should turn up any time now." Ugluk's words were enough, apparently, to satisfy the Isengarders, but the other orcs were both dispirited and rebellious. They posted a few watchers, but most of them lay on the ground, resting in the pleasant darkness. It did indeed become very dark again, for the moon passed westward into thick cloud, and Pippin could not see anything a few feet away. The fires brought no light to the hillock. The riders were not, however, content merely to wait for the dawn and let their enemies rest. A sudden outcry on the east side of the knoll showed that something was wrong. It seemed that some of the men had ridden in close, slipped off their horses, crawled to the edge of the camp, and killed several orcs, and then had faded away again. Ugluk dashed off to stop a stampede. Pippin and Merry sat up. Their guards, Isengarders, had gone with Ugluk. But if the hobbits had any thought of escape, it was soon dashed. A long, hairy arm took each of them by the neck and drew them close together. Dimly they were aware of Grishnak's great head and hideous face between them. His foul breath was on their cheeks. He began to paw them and feel them. Pippin shuddered as hard, cold fingers groped down his back.
"Well, my little ones," said Grishnak in a soft whisper, "enjoying a nice rest or not? A little awkwardly placed, perhaps. Swords and whips on one side and nasty spears on the other. Little people shouldn't meddle in affairs that are too big for them." His fingers continued to grope. There was a light like a pale but hot fire behind his eyes. The thought came suddenly into Pippin's mind, as if caught direct from the urgent thought of his enemy.
"Grishnak knows about the ring. He's looking for it, while Ugluk is busy. He probably wants it for himself."
Cold fear was in Pippin's heart, yet at the same time he was wondering what use he could make of Grishnak's desire.
"I don't think you'll find it that way," he whispered. "It isn't easy to find."
"Find it?" said Grishnak. His fingers stopped crawling and gripped Pippin's shoulder. "Find what? What are you talking about, little one?"
For a moment Pippin was silent. Then suddenly in the darkness he made a noise in his throat.
"Gollum, Gollum."
"Nothing, my precious," he added.
The hobbits felt Grishnak's fingers twitch.
"Oh-ho," hissed the goblin softly. "That's what he means, is it? Oh-ho, very, very dangerous, my little ones."
"Perhaps," said Merry, now alert and aware of Pippin's guess.
"Perhaps, and not only for us. Still, you know your business best. Do you want it or not? And what would you give for it?"
"Do I want it? Do I want it?" said Grishnak, as if puzzled, but his arms were trembling. "What would I give for it? What do you mean?"
"We mean," said Pippin, choosing his words carefully, "that it's no good groping in the dark. We could save you time and trouble. But you must untie our legs first, or we'll do nothing and say nothing."
"My dear tender little fools," hissed Grishnak, "everything you have and everything you know will be got out of you in due time, everything. You'll wish there was more than you could tell to satisfy the questioner, and indeed you will, quite soon. We shan't hurry the inquiry. Oh, dear, no. What do you think you've been kept alive for? My dear little fellows, please believe me when I say that it wasn't out of kindness. That's not even one of Ugluk's faults."
"I find it quite easy to believe," said Merry. "But you haven't got your prey home yet, and it doesn't seem to be going your way, whatever happens. If we come to Isengard, it won't be the great Grishnak that benefits. Saruman will take all that he can find. If you want anything for yourself, now's the time to do a deal."
Grishnak began to lose his temper. The name of Saruman seemed specially to enrage him. Time was passing, and the disturbance was dying down. Ugluk or the Isengarders might return at any minute.
"Have you got it, either of you?" he snarled.
"Gollum, Gollum," said Pippin.
"Untie our legs," said Merry. They felt the orc's arms trembling violently.
"Curse you, you filthy little vermin," he hissed. "Untie your legs. I'll untie every string in your bodies. Do you think I can't search you to the bones? Search you? I'll cut you both to quivering shreds. I don't need the help of your legs to get you away and have you all to myself."
Suddenly he seized them. The strength in his long arms and shoulders was terrifying. He tucked them one under each armpit and crushed them fiercely to his sides. A great stifling hand was clapped over each of their mouths. Then he sprang forward, stooping low. Quickly and silently he went, until he came to the edge of the knoll. There, choosing a gap between the watchers, he passed like an evil shadow out into the night, down the slope and away westward towards the river that flowed out of the forest. In that direction there was a wide open space with only one fire. After going a dozen yards he halted, peering and listening. Nothing could be seen or heard. He crept slowly on, bent almost double. Then he squatted and listened again. Then he stood up, as if to risk a sudden dash. At that very moment the dark form of a rider loomed up right in front of him. A horse snorted and reared. A man called out. Grishnak flung himself on the ground flat, dragging the hobbits under him. Then he drew his sword. No doubt he meant to kill his captives, rather than allow them to escape or to be rescued. But it was his undoing. The sword rang faintly, and glinted a little in the light of the fire away to his left. An arrow came whistling out of the gloom. It was aimed with skill, or guided by fate, and it pierced his right hand. He dropped the sword and shrieked. There was a quick beat of hoofs, and even as Grishnak leapt up and ran, he was ridden down, and a spear passed through him. He gave a hideous shivering cry and lay still. The hobbits remained flat on the ground, as Grishnak had left them. Another horseman came riding swiftly to his comrade's aid. Whether because of some special keenness of sight, or because of some other sense, the horse lifted and sprang lightly over them, but its rider did not see them. Lying covered in their elven cloaks,
too crushed for the moment and too afraid to move.
This ends Disc 2.